Bonjour. Bonjour à tous. Bonjour à tous. Bienvenue tout le monde. Je suis honoré de présenter la première conférence publique de le nouvel centre Ludmer pour la neuroinformatique et sentimentale. My name is Alan Evans. I'm a co-director of the Ludmer Center for Neuroinformatics and Mental Health. My colleague Michael Meany here is another co-director, and Celia Greenwood, who's in the audience somewhere, is a third co-director. This may seem like an unusual arrangement, but the Ludmer Center itself is an unusual arrangement. It's a bold vision that brings together multiple institutions with different scientific backgrounds towards a more comprehensive understanding of the brain, how it works in child development, and how the environment affects the development of the child. I'm sure that everybody in the room is well aware of the data tsunami, where it's surrounded on all sides by information. Well, science is no different. And we in the brain sciences community, we can collect data on genetics, imaging, psychological testing, all kinds of information. We can also collect information about how the environment affects the genes. You're going to hear an awful lot about that today from Michael and Sonia. The challenge of the Ludmer Center has been to help pull all of that information into one holistic description of the brain, of your child's brain, of your elderly parent's brain. And over the next few years, we're going to be giving a number of public lectures on various topics of relevance to the community and our understanding of the brain. So I should point out that this public lecture was advertised. Within 24 hours, this room was full. This shows you the level of interest in the community on this particular topic. So we were forced to put in two overflow rooms, the Meekins and the Martin rooms outside, and Joanne Clark, the executive director of the Ludmer Center, Joanne, would you wave? She's going to take charge of the Martin room to help moderate the process. Si vous souhaitez poser des questions, écrivez-les sur les cartes fournies avec votre package de bienvenue. Et le donner aux bénévoles dans les allées. Les bénévoles, est-ce que ici? OK. So, the format of the process is going to be that Michael will give his talk, followed by Sonia, and then there will be a question and answer format. So, it's going to be an exciting night. I have to introduce Michael. It's going to be a difficult process. Michael is both a friend and partner in crime, but once in a while I have to do this in a formal manner, introduce him as a leading scientist in the world community in the study of child development and the influence of the environment on child development. So if you'll bear with me for a few moments, he doesn't want me to do this, but it has to be done. Michael is a James McGill professor in the departments of psychiatry and neurology. He's a co-director of the Ludmer Center and a recipient of numerous national and international honors. He was named a most highly cited scientist in the area of neuroscience in 2007 and continues to rank amongst the world's most cited scientists in the field. He's a world authority on stress, maternal care, and epigenetics. He's been invited to present at research institutes, government health agencies, and scientific meetings worldwide, and consults internationally on numerous studies. He's a senior scientist and director of the Maternal Adversity and Vulnerability and Neurodevelopment Study, otherwise known as MAVEN, and a sister project of a similar nature called GUSTO in Singapore. In 2014, he was awarded the prestigious Klaus J. Jacobs Research Prize for scientific work of high social relevance in child development. He was also elected to the Royal Society of Canada and is a Chevalier de l'Ordre National du Québec. So I'm excited to hear Michael when he does his thing, because I work too closely with him. I never get to see him as an audience member. I'm very much excited to hear Michael do his thing. Over to you, Michael.
Thank you. It's an honor. And thank you for coming. This is the inaugural Ludmer Center public lecture. And I've done lots of public lectures, but I'll admit to being nervous. So this is going to go. And part of the reason was, when we set this up, and Irving will remember this, is that one of the people who was a key player in this was Hartley Stern at the Jewish General Hospital. And he had a major role in bringing the bodies together that created the center. And so I turned to Hartley at one point and asked, and just commented on how wonderful this was. And Hartley said, "Yep, don't mess it up." Except he didn't say mess. And that was what I was thinking about as I walked out here. Okay, so poverty and the brain. I'll tell you what I'd like to do. As build, I want to walk you through some work that we do at the level of the genome. And I want to talk about, in particular, how childhood family experience is embedded in your biology. Embedded in a manner that is sustained and that comes to influence individual differences in health outcomes and capacity over the lifespan. I want to talk about what is perhaps somewhat surprising to some of you, but how it is that this effect can actually lurk within your DNA. How the social influence can be imprinted on your DNA. The fact that this imprint is stable over time helps us to understand why it is that the experience of early childhood can, in fact, influence our health and well-being over the course of the lifespan. So these are the themes I want to get to. But I do want to walk you through a little bit of the issues related to poverty and brain. And I want to do so in particular because many of my colleagues, younger colleagues for the most part, are, I think, doing some absolutely dynamite work in terms of helping us to understand how it is that socioeconomic status comes to influence the way in which our brain perceives the world, responds to threat in the world, and thus influences our health. So I'm going to walk you through a little bit of that before we get to the so-called epigenetic part. First of all, just to position us, this is where Canada sits in terms of child poverty. We're slightly above the OECD level, which is certainly, I think, should be something of an embarrassment to us. In our particular province, however, we fare rather well. We have the lowest rate of childhood poverty in Canada. And perhaps not surprisingly, within Quebec, we also have the highest index of the early childhood education measure. And this is a measure that was developed in large part by Clyde Hertzman at the University of British Columbia. It's used internationally, and it comes to predict the capacity of the child, and particularly their performance in primary school. And you'll notice Quebec does sterlingly well there. No doubt that has something to do with its position in terms of child poverty. There is also speculation on the role of our child care system in buttressing child and children and preparing them for school. Now, I do want to come to a particular apology. There are people in the audience, and I know of two of them, Rebecca and Margaret Locke, who know much more about poverty than I'll ever know. In fact, they'll forget more about it than I'll ever know. And I just want you to know that I'm not here to tell you about what it is about poverty per se. I'm here more to tell you about its effects at the level of the brain. I realize that poverty is contextual, that, for example, being poor in a situation in which there is relatively less violence, such as, thankfully, our own city, is very different from being poor in a community in which there's horrific violence, in which exposure to violence is highly, highly stratified by socioeconomic status. And I also realize that it's blended with ethnicity. For example, when we look in our Singapore data, we don't see any effects of ethnicity that aren't explained by SES. So there's a blend of ethnicity and socioeconomic status. These are dynamic, very deep, and very culturally and contextually determined influences. I'm not going to go there. It's not my area of expertise. I just want you to know that I do have the deepest respect for the expertise that isn't going to be given out tonight. So what I can do, though, is just to refresh your memory on things that, no doubt, you're here, so you know that there's something very important about poverty. It influences, amongst other things, success, not merely our health, but our success, our capacity. This is university participation rates. These are Canadian statistics. And what you'll notice is that as one ascends the socioeconomic ladder, there's a greater participation rate of the children. Almost 2 to 3 times as many kids from high SES compared to low SES are participating in university. And of course, health. If you look, for example, at the relationship between poverty and mental health, that if you ask people to describe the quality of their own mental health, that about twice as many people who are well-educated and financially more comfortable will describe themselves as having excellent mental health compared to those who are less well-educated and living below the poverty line. So there's clearly an influence there. And here's what I'd like you to keep in mind, because I want to come back to this point. Yes, there's clearly an effect of poverty. But you'll notice this statistic is far from 100%, and this one's far from zero. Bear that in mind, because I do want to come back to that particular point. Mental health. I mean, we could show slide after slide. Virtually every major form of mental disorder is strongly influenced by SES. And although I'm not going to belabor this particular point, the evidence, not only for mental health, but for cardiovascular disease, metabolic disease, is rather compelling that childhood poverty is a much greater and more significant influence on health than is concurrent or adult socioeconomic status. So being poor during childhood, even if you ascend into a higher economic strata later on, has its imprint. And I think that's a point that we want to really keep in mind, because it's, again, I'm not going to emphasize it, but I am indeed going to be talking mostly about childhood socioeconomic status. Now, I want to just try to deal with a certain number of questions that are fundamental to understanding the literature and the science in this area. And, of course, one of the key questions, and I raise this question in particular, because this is an issue that bears heavily on the public health implications. Politicians will turn to us, for example, very often and say, well, is this cause and effect? Does poverty lead to poor mental health and impair academic performance, or does poor mental health and poor academic performance lead to poverty? Right? Also very clever, but the evidence for this is overwhelming in favor of this particular conclusion. For example, if you look as young as 3 to 4 years of age, both in the United Kingdom as well as the United States, you see that literacy and numeracy skills are highly stratified by socioeconomic status. Kids who are born poor are doing less well. They're less prepared to go into school. That's true of both of these countries, and it would seem rather unlikely that a child's poor vocabulary at 3 years of age causes the family to be poor. You'll buy that? Good. And we see these gaps not only when you start looking at school readiness, but you can see behavioral problems as well emerging, and they're all stratified by socioeconomic status. Now, this is a literature that I'm not going to go too far down, largely because I don't know that much about it, but it's a wonderfully interesting point to make because of the strength of the findings in this area. Essentially, where I'm going to take you, I'm going to walk you through a story that I think the people in sociology and social psychology, child development, have worked out reasonably well, is that when you talk about the influence of poverty, you're talking about basically two major outcomes as far as the brain is concerned. You're talking about how well people are positioned to go to school, to do well in school, and then ultimately succeed. And those are the things we talk about in terms of human capacity. The second component is we're talking more about emotional development and how well, for example, one is able to regulate their own emotional states, how well they do with stress and the demands of their lives. And those are the two major outcomes that have been well studied with respect to poverty. The first, that is the academic achievement, the cognitive skills that prepare a child for school, largely seem to be determined by what people call the level of cognitive stimulation available in the home. You can, for example, predict how well kids are going to do in school by simply counting up the number of books that are in the home environment, right? So cognitive stimulation seems to be the way in which this is driven, and poverty then impairs the resources of the family to create that level of cognitive stimulation. Now, the second component, though, is very different, and that's the one I'm going to focus on, and it's largely through family function and parenting that these effects on emotional development are witnessed. But here is some work, and if you're at all interested in the issue of language and cognitive development, it's a book by Hart and Risley that was written quite some time ago, but has been enormously influential. What you're looking at, what these people actually did was they wired up parents and counted the number of words that parents expressed to their kids at a regular time over the course of development. And what they found was that people who were of professional class, better educated, higher socioeconomic status, were speaking about three times as many words to their children as were people who were in low-income families. That difference was apparent largely by 24 months of age, and that's at exactly at the point in time at which your kids start to diverge in terms of their vocabulary and their development. So you see the way in which poverty starts to infest in terms of cognitive development. Okay, I want to take you to one brilliant experiment. It was done very accidentally by a wonderful psychiatrist. And this, I think, seals the deal as far as talking about the influence of poverty and the financial means of the family. So Jane Costello's at Duke University, and she was working in the Great Smoky Mountains with disadvantaged populations in the Appalachian Hills. And she was, about half of the population was made up of American Indians, otherwise they were Caucasians. And so what she did was to simply count and assess the number of behavioral problems, psychiatric symptoms expressed by the children within the family. And she found that people who were poor, their kids had about twice as many symptoms of psychiatric illness as those who were not poor. And then what happened was the government came in and signed a deal. And they said, you need a casino. Sure, everybody needs a casino, right? Now, they wanted to build a casino on the land that was owned by the Native Americans. So, they had to pay them. And when they paid them, they were no longer poor. And so what happened was that when she came back a year after, 2 years after, 3 years after, she found that people whose kids were previously poor but no longer poor had behavioral problems that were no different from those kids who had never been poor, right? It was an accidental experiment, and it was a wonderful one. So, yes, it is indeed poverty that's driving these particular outcomes. And as I mentioned, the way in which we talk about these is in terms of the family. Because the way in which the child learns and knows about their world is through their family, and particularly through their interactions with their parents. And so these broader forces, culture, the level of violence, the socioeconomic status of the individuals within their neighborhood, these forces affect the development of children through their influence on family function. And indeed, we can talk about a whole range of factors, all of which are linked to socioeconomic status. We can talk about prenatal. I'm going to emphasize largely postnatal, but it's not at all because there's evidence lacking for effect of socioeconomic status on fetal, prenatal development. Those studies are done and compelling. Parental care is a major factor, and as I've already mentioned, the level of cognitive stimulation provided in the family is also very much linked to these. And these factors cumulatively then guide us towards different patterns of brain development. Now, when we start to talk about the health of the individual, in large measure, and we're moving primarily towards emotional development here, is that poverty is associated with an increased risk for family dysfunction. And so these forms of familial dysfunction can occur anywhere across the population, but they tend to be occurring more likely amongst those families that are poor. It's not terribly hard to imagine. The burden of poverty compromises the mental health of the parents and thus the quality of their interactions with their kids. And these come to then predict each one of these health risks. Now, although I'm emphasizing the brain, the interesting part is that these effects are not unique to brain-based or what we classically think of as brain-based disorders. You can find, for example, that these factors are just as predictive of obesity and diabetes as they are for depression, drug abuse, and anxiety. So health in general is being shaped by these particular forces. Indeed, quality of parental mental health, as it is the quality of mental health of any adults, is associated with poverty. Individuals who live below the poverty line, that is less than 100% at the poverty line, are more likely to suffer from serious psychological distress than are those who live well above it, about four times more likely. Now, what that does cumulatively is to disrupt the family and to produce a series of experiences to the child that are referred to as adverse childhood experiences, and these experiences then come to predict health outcomes. So I'm just going to digress for a moment. This is work that was initiated by Vincent Folletti, who was an internist in San Francisco, largely dealing with adolescent obesity, and came to recognize that particularly amongst the females within his practice, that he saw an overwhelming percentage of obese children who had suffered from abuse or neglect or emotional abuse in early life. And he started to study it. And what he created is something called the ACE Index, Adverse Childhood Experiences. All of them are listed, as you see right down here. And essentially, he counted them up. And the number of these adverse experiences predicts virtually every single form of non-communicable chronic disease. It is massive in terms of its predictive value. The other thing that's worth noting is that individuals, for the most part, tend to be in the slightly risky to high-risk area once they go from two of these experiences above. And you'll notice that that describes half of the, almost half, of the population that he studied, which was 27,000 people living in Northern California. So these forms of adversity are certainly not unique, and they're highly predictive, as I mentioned. These are just a couple of examples. The greater the number of adverse childhood experiences, the greater the risk for alcoholism, the greater the risk for depression, the greater the risk for diabetes, for multiple forms of cardiovascular disease, etc. And not surprisingly, the experience of individuals is linked to poverty. People who live below the poverty line have about twice to 2.5 times as likely to have 2 or 3 or more of these adverse experiences than people who live well above the poverty line. So adversity tracks socioeconomic status. Now again, I'd like you to keep this slide in mind because indeed we are talking about a preponderance of adverse experience amongst families that live within poverty. But do note, it's not unique to those populations, right? And we'll come back to that. If you look at various forms of adversity to which children are exposed, they're all more plentiful amongst those who live at or near the poverty line compared to those who live well above it. So this, not surprisingly, led to some work that Sonia had done here in Montreal, showing that indeed kids who are in low SES show higher levels of stress hormones over early childhood compared to those who live in middle class settings. So yes, adversity is linked, familial adversity is linked to the quality of the socioeconomic status. And as I mentioned to you, child psychologists in particular have worked out that most of the features of poverty that affect emotional development are driven through family experience and in particular parental care. Okay, so the question then becomes, well, how does that happen? How does parenting, if you will, get under the skin and influence health outcomes over the lifespan? And the pathway that most people assume is operative here is one in which poverty does indeed disrupt the function of the family, and it then influences individual differences in the way in which people respond to stress. And these individual differences in stress responses then come to predict these particular health outcomes. That's the pathway that's currently favored by the literature. And so what I want to talk about in particular are this, the individual differences and how that's studied within the framework of neuroscience. So here's a somewhat simplistic, but I think reasonably accurate way of which think of the cognitive and perceptual processes by which the brain processes a threatening or potentially threatening stimuli and ultimately resulting in a stress response or a response akin to fear. Well, the heart of this is a brain region in the limbic area known as the amygdala. The amygdala functions very much the same way in any mammal. It is there largely to detect any particular stimuli that may be potentially threatening to the individual. So it's a sensor of threat, if you will. Now, the amygdala does rarely, only in extreme cases, will the amygdala directly activate a stress response. What happens more frequently is that information from the amygdala is transmitted through the hippocampus and the prefrontal cortex, and that this unit functions together to determine whether or not the individual ultimately comes to mobilize a stress response. Interestingly, Kids from low socioeconomic settings are more likely to interpret an ambiguous situation as being threatening. And that is largely because of altered activity within this circuit. Now, the interesting point is that not only is the activity of the circuit related to stress responses, it is also the most heavily studied circuit in understanding why people are predisposed to disorders such as depression and anxiety. And largely, individuals who are vulnerable for these disorders show increased activity within the amygdala, and in particular, decreased activity within the prefrontal cortex. So hold that combination in mind, if you will. Now, depression, anxiety, is indeed associated with increased activity in the amygdala, and this associates with a greater sensitivity to threat and greater fearfulness. In one experiment, for example, researchers took undergraduate students. They asked the students to rate where they stood on a socioeconomic ladder during their childhood, low versus high. And that rating predicted the degree to which the amygdala responded to an angry, threatening face. So you see a lovely correlation here, powerful correlation between the individual's perceived and reported socioeconomic status in childhood and the degree to which their amygdala responded to these stressful events. Now, if you think about it for a moment, we're talking about poverty as an event, as a condition that enhances these forms of experience, abusive, physically abusive, sexually abusive, emotionally neglectful circumstances in the family. And I've just told you that these circumstances associate with an increased response in the amygdala. Now I want to tell you about a study that's done by Seth Pollack. I'm going to walk you through this because it's a complex experiment, but I think it's also a brilliant one in terms of its importance in understanding these particular effects. So what Seth Pollack, who's at the University of Wisconsin, did was he took faces of individuals and he morphed them using computer software, and he morphed them so that the face could appear fearful or gradually morphing towards happy. Happy, morphing towards sad. Fearful, morphing towards angry, etc. And then he showed individuals repeatedly each of these individual faces and asked them to rank what was the emotion that they saw within the face of the individual. And essentially he was asking, at what point do people, for example, see fearfulness becoming anger? And what he found was that for kids who were abused in early life, they perceived anger much more readily than did kids from controlled family. In other words, these kids were seeing angry here, whereas the kids from the control situation were seeing angry over here. They were more sensitive to the expression of anger. They grew up in a sexually and physically abusive household. You want to be more sensitive to threat, don't you? Make sense? You have to be. Exactly. This is preservation. So in these particular cases, what we're really talking about is not so much a toxic effect as much as an adaptive one. And interestingly enough, two wonderful psychologists, David Farrington in London and Richard Tremblay here in Montreal, have done virtually the same study. They've looked at young boys living in impoverished and more violent circumstances and found that when they looked at what it was that predicted those boys that did well, fearfulness and timidity was a positive predictor. Now think of it. You're growing up in a crime-rested environment. Being more fearful and timid is likely to keep you from following down pathways that otherwise might lead you to a maladaptive outcome. So we can think of fearfulness, I think, as being clearly determined by these events, but potentially by being adaptive. Now the other side of the coin. Decreased anxiety is also associated with decreased activity in the hippocampus and the prefrontal cortex. So yes, it increases. You see increased activity in the amygdala, but you also see decreased activity. And this is what appears to be the really major predictor of psychiatric outcomes. What happens in the course of the activation of a mildly stressful circumstance, the amygdala alerts this circuit that something potentially threatening has occurred. And the frontal cortex is the type of, is the structure that turns around and says, we can deal with this, this isn't that serious, we've seen this before, there are safety, there are resources, etc. In other words, the prefrontal cortex signals can inhibit the activity of the amygdala. Now, that inhibition, okay, now we know the Soprano fans in the audience. That inhibition is what results in emotional regulation. It is the prefrontal cortex that is regulating emotional states within the amygdala. Emotional dysregulation, even in the presence of a reasonably smart individual, doesn't necessarily work out. You remember the black screen? Okay, I'm pushing it. When you look at the structures that are regulating the amygdala, it includes the hippocampus, the prefrontal cortex. These structures, as well as the amygdala, are associated with socioeconomic status. The measure here is a common one that's used. It's income to needs ratio. And as you can imagine, if your income exceeds your needs, you're doing better. And if it's the other way around, you're not. And what you see is that individuals, for example, who are in better socioeconomic circumstances, is that their kids are showing a larger hippocampus. Kids who are born in poverty are showing a larger amygdala. You're seeing the imbalance here in these particular states. We can look at it from the other side of the coin. Maternal support actually enhances the volume of the hippocampus. So again, structures that are largely there to either position information associated with stress or to dampen it are being promoted by either high socioeconomic status or by parental control. Now I want to take you, I'm going to walk you through this because this is really the key experiment. It's done by Israel Lieberman at the University of Michigan. Now again, he's using the same income to needs ratio. And so what to keep in mind is that at this end of the scale are people whose income well exceeds their needs or whose family's income well exceeds their family's needs. And at this end, it's in fact the reverse. The needs exceeded the income. What you see is that those regions of the prefrontal cortex right here that are primarily involved in regulating the activity in the amygdala are enhanced in terms of their activity given a threatening situation in kids that were raised in high versus low socioeconomic status. So the people here, this is a functional magnetic resonance imaging. The kids here are being exposed to those angry faces. And what the researchers are doing is to look at activity within the prefrontal cortex as well as within the amygdala. And what you see is that those individuals faced with a potentially threatening stimuli who were raised in higher socioeconomic status activate the prefrontal cortex to a greater extent than do kids who are raised in poverty. That's true of these two regions of the prefrontal cortex as well as the insula. The amygdala shows exactly the opposite. And again, keep in mind what I pointed to is the prefrontal cortex under these circumstances is inhibiting the activity normally to mildly stressful information in the amygdala. And what you see here is reduced activity in the prefrontal cortex is associated with increased activity in the amygdala. And that's essentially an inability to emotionally regulate under those circumstances. This decrease in activity in the prefrontal cortex is mediated by the level of chronic stress during adolescence, in fact. And, of course, what it's doing is to impair the ability of the prefrontal cortex to appropriately regulate the amygdala. And so what you end up with then is an association that lies between poverty, familial dysfunction, and emotional regulation. And that's really what the critical feature is here. This is what's so damaging, both in terms of mental health, as well as in terms of many other particular outcomes. This is a study, again, I'll take the time and walk you through it, but it's a study that was done by Terry Moffat looking longitudinally at a population in New Zealand. These are individuals in whom self-control or emotional regulation was determined in childhood. And what they found was that kids who were low on childhood self-emotional regulation had poorer health outcomes compared to those who were high. They were more likely to have a range of problems associated with criminality, and financially, essentially, anything that was good was more common amongst those with high emotional regulation, and financial problems and other misfortunes were more likely amongst those who were low in self-control or emotional regulation. So emotional regulation is a feature of the brain's response and processing of information associated with stress, and it is shaped directly and immediately by parental care, and in a broader sense, by socioeconomic factors. If you're interested, by the way, here's a fantastic book. I mean, I still remember this from my intro to sociology class many years ago. It's the best thing that came from that course, was reading Street Corner Society. It's an absolutely famous book. It's a book about young men living in an Italian-American slum in North Boston, and it talks about what goes on within that particular context. That's a context of poverty, right? And yet it's clear that the individuals who succeeded, who became leaders of the local gangs, were individuals who were high in emotional regulation. They could problem solve. They weren't put out by threat. They kept their head cool under pressure. So the point is that while fearfulness may be adaptive in these particular contexts, emotional dysregulation is never adaptive. In any context within which people operate, emotional regulation is to our advantage. Okay, that's, I think, a picture that's emerging. As I mentioned to you, neuroscience, I think young neuroscientists in particular, have really started to grapple with some societal problems, and it's really exciting to see what they're actually producing. And that's a bit of an overview, I think, of much of the work that's being done in this particular field. A lot of it, many studies, by the way, I gave you a few examples, many studies working on this particular issue of the response of individuals to threat, and particularly their ability to emotionally regulate. Okay, so now I want to get you to what is the part that I promised you at the beginning. I want to talk about how it is that the effects of socioeconomic status, and in more directly the effects of family function on brain, how those effects occur to begin with, but most importantly, how it is that they're sustained in terms of brain function. So how are social influence biologically embedded in brain cells? And in particular, how is it that these effects persist into adulthood? What I'm going to do is to focus again on this particular circuit here. I'm going to talk about how it is that, in particular, parental care can regulate individual differences in response to stress. And here, I'm going to take us down to the level that we need to get to if we're going to deal with the biology. So I'm going to talk about an animal for which I have the greatest respect and affection. These are Long Evans hooded rats. Okay, they are wonderful animals, I have to say. Make great pets. Okay, so that may take some convincing. But they do make great mothers. And here what you see is a Long Evans hooded rat mother nursing her many offspring. And during the course of the nursing, what she does is to lick her pup. Licking of the pup, by the way, alters the endocrine systems of the pup. It enhances the release of growth hormone. It suppresses catabolic hormones. It actually enhances ongoing somatic growth in the pup. So it has an immediate impact. And the interesting thing about this is that there are these very, very stable individual differences in mother rats. There are mother rats who lick their pups about 2 to 3 times as frequently as do other mothers. And they don't just lick them one day. They lick them throughout the entire period of lactation. These mothers lick their pups more frequently than these. And if you breed them again, these mothers persist in being high-licking mothers and low-licking mothers. So the reason for that, of course, is that now we've got a model. We can start to think, how could variations in a social signal, right, the mother's interaction with her pup, how could that come to influence brain development and brain function? And we've studied this with respect to a number of particular outcomes. We've looked at endocrine and behavioral responses to stress. We've looked at the development of specific brain regions, particularly the hippocampus and prefrontal cortex. We've looked at specific forms of learning and memory. And we've looked at metabolism and reproduction. And the effects are fairly widespread. For example, although I digress, the offspring of low-licking mothers become virtually fully diabetic by midlife, particularly the females. So there's profound influences on a wide range of phenotypes. And then the critical question is, well, can you link those to these variations in maternal care? And the answer is yes, you can. You can, for example, do a simple cross-fostering study. You can take pups that are the biological offspring of low-licking mothers and foster them onto highs. You can take animals that are born to highs and foster them onto lows. And when you do, you essentially reverse either in part or completely every one of these outcomes, which suggests that, yep, mom's licking is driving the variation in these particular outcomes. Now I want to talk about the stress response, so I need to delve a little bit into some endocrine details. I want to talk in particular about the hormonal response to stress, the classic pituitary adrenal response. Now, in response to virtually any major form of stressor, there are cells in the hypothalamus that release a hormone that is known as corticotropin-releasing factor. And it releases vasopressin and a few others, but collectively what these hormones do is they signal the pituitary to release another hormone known as ACTH, and then eventually the adrenals respond to ATH with the release of glucocorticoids, and in humans the classic glucocorticoid is cortisol, which is thus referred to in many cases as a stress hormone. Now, that's the way we activate a stress response. It's driven in particular by the amygdala and by other projections into the hypothalamus. And it's inhibited in large measure by the hippocampus. And the way that inhibition occurs is as follows. The glucocorticoids, cortisol, that's released from the adrenal gland, it acts quickly at the level of the pituitary and says, okay, enough with the ACTH. It acts at the hypothalamus and similarly dampens CRF. But what it also does is it signals areas outside the hypothalamus, and in particular the hippocampus. So glucocorticoids interact with these glucocorticoid receptor proteins on hippocampal neurons, and the net effect is to inhibit CRF. It's a classic negative feedback loop, right? High levels of glucocorticoids dampen CRF in the hypothalamus. They do it by interacting with these glucocorticoid receptors. And what we know is that animals that were reared by high-licking mothers, these are adult animals, have a more modest pituitary ACTH and adrenal glucocorticoid response to stress than do animals that were reared by low-licking mothers, who, in fact, have a greater pituitary and adrenal response. And the reason for that difference is that the animals that are reared by high-licking mothers produce more of these glucocorticoid receptors. They are more sensitive to glucocorticoids, and they are more successful in inhibiting CRF, and they dampen their stress response. Animals that are raised by low-licking mothers produce fewer glucocorticoid receptors, they're not as good at regulating CRF, and they thus have a greater pituitary and adrenal response to stress. All of this is regulated by the activity of a gene in the hippocampus that produces glucocorticoid receptors. That gene is more active in animals that are reared by high compared to low-licking mothers, and thus these animals are better able to regulate their response to stress. You can take this to ridiculous extremes, and we do. So, not only can you actually score the amount of licking a mother extends to her pups, you can score licking to individual pups. And when you do, you find that those pups that are licked more frequently, as adults, produce more of these glucocorticoid receptors. So the question then becomes, how is it that maternal care operates in the first week of life to determine the activity of the glucocorticoid receptor gene in adulthood? How does that happen? How is it that the effect is sustained? I mean, these pups are weaned, right? They go off to college, they don't write, except when they need money. So how is that effect sustained? Okay, so here's where I take you through a little bit and walk you through what we think is the mechanism that in part at least accounts for that. Into every public lecture, right, a little bit of this detail must insert itself. So I'm going to give you two versions of this, okay? So if you're into the details, you can attend to the next minute or two. And if you're not, you're going to get a summary and an overview, which is, should, I think, take you as far as you need to know. Okay, but the story about epigenetics is, I think, in a broader sense, quite interesting. Back in the year 2000, we had this amazing optimism for the Human Genome Project, right? We were going to explain human diversity on the basis of diversity at the level of the genome. And by the way, I'm a big fan of the Human Genome Project, so don't get me wrong. But there was a problem. We figured, well, simple organisms like carrots and what have you, 20, 30,000 genes. Humans, we're so complex, we're so wonderful. What do we must have 200, 300, 400,000 genes? Not so much. These are water fleas. They have 31,000 genes. We have 27,000. This is the sight of a water flea laughing when it finds out how many genes we have. We have about 3 billion or so base pairs. Here's a lungfish. It is 133 billion. Genetic complexity? Not so much. So in essence, we have now come to rely on this. What I like is to be able to draw the women in the audience into this, okay? Normally, only half the audience resonates to this particular phrase. Okay, so you've got to do something interesting. Let's face it, we do have to beat these water fleas at chess, right? So somehow we've got to get our DNA to do things that are interesting and diverse, and we do. And that's really what the heart of complexity is all about. So let me just walk you through a little bit of why and how we produce this diversity. So the basic process by which genes, I mean, you can inherit different variants of genes, but for those variants to be in any way effective, the gene must be activated. It has to be expressed, right? And so the way that occurs is that a class of proteins known as transcription factors bind to regulatory regions on the DNA, promoter regions, as Hans can tell you, and they activate these genes. Now, the interesting part as well is that, in essence, this whole process has to have an environmental component in many ways, because the activity of these transcription factors that regulate gene expression, their activity is controlled by hormones, drugs, nutrients, and other stimuli that themselves, in many ways, are driven by the broader environment. So in fact, the whole process by which a gene is activated in many ways involves these so-called environmental events. So the transcription factors interact with the gene, and here's the problem. For the most part, when you look at your DNA, it's not linear. It's wrapped and curled and bundled up into something called the nucleosome. So this is the way most DNA looks. It's packaged in a nucleosome, which is about 146 base pairs, wrapped tightly around a histone core. Now, it's sustained by electrostatic bonds. Histones are positively charged, DNA is negatively charged. And the problem is, in this closed configurations, transcription factors have trouble accessing their binding sites. And therefore, they can't regulate and activate the gene. In other words, if you want the gene to be active, you have to activate the transcription factor, but you also have to remodel this complex so the transcription factor can influence the DNA. And one of the common ways that occurs is through simple acetylation. You add an acetyl group onto the tails of these histone proteins. It neutralizes the positive charge, opens up the nucleosome, and now the transcription factor can bind, right? And so it's an active process. You not only need to have the transcription factor bonding, you actually have to remodel, in many ways, the environment within which DNA operates. But there are also signals that operate over a longer period of time and have much more stable effects. And in many cases, these are modifications that occur not on the histone tails, but rather on the DNA themselves. And the classic case, this has been studied for years, is that of DNA methylation. So we know that over the course of development, certain regions, base pairs on the DNA, acquire a methyl group. And that methyl group can be very important in terms of determining gene expression. When regions of the DNA carry these methyl groups, they attract a class of proteins known as methylated DNA binding proteins. And they attract an enzyme known as histone deacetylase, which of course does exactly the opposite of histone acetylase. It kicks the acetyl groups off the histones and prevents reacetylation. And in doing so, it ensures that this nucleosome remains closed. So that's the way methylation is actually working. It's working by suppressing the ability of this nucleosome to become open. And when it does, the transcription factors can't bind. So DNA methylation, then, is largely associated with the silencing of DNA. So effectively, what occurs is that, indeed, as you acquire these methylated signals, the gene starts to become progressively silenced. So regions of the gene that don't contain a methylation signal are active. As they acquire the methyl groups, they become increasingly inactive. And now we can start to understand why some genes are more active than others, simply by virtue of these epigenetic signals, such as DNA methylation. And that helps us to understand what are some really fundamental puzzles in human or in developmental biology in general. So one puzzle, you make about 225 or more different cell types. You have muscle cells, epithelial cells, brain cells, skin cells, etc. They all have the same DNA, exactly the same DNA. So how do you produce cells that are as different in their function as liver and brain cells when they're all working from a common DNA template? And the way you do it is through these events. So essentially, if you look in a brain cell, yeah, you're going to find some genes that are as active in brain cells as they are in blood, but you'll find other genes that are active in brain but not in blood because they carry these methylation signals. So methylation is associated then with the process by which you produce functionally different genomes. And so even though you've got a common DNA template, you produce many different epigenomes, and those associate with different types of cells. Now, that can also explain some wonderful mysteries in biology. Honeybees, for example. You look into a hive, you find worker bees, drones, and queens. These guys, small, short-lived. Drones, a little bigger, live a little longer. Queens, big, live forever. Okay? Genetically identical. They are literally clones of each other. How do you produce such variation, right, in outcome, when you're working from exactly the same DNA template? This Gene Robinson and others at the University of Illinois have shown is due to DNA methylation. And it takes us to one more wonderful puzzle, right? There's no question that we inherit genetic variants from our parents that can increase or decrease our risk for particular disorders. But we know that even in the cases of highly heritable disorders like schizophrenia, there's incredible discordance, right? So if an identical twin is diagnosed with psychosis and schizophrenia, the chance of the other twin developing is about 45% or so, 50. Alcoholism, it's less. It's greater than the normal population, but it's not 100%. So how do we create diversity? Well, it may not surprise you to know that the mom of Phil and Fred doesn't have a lot of trouble telling them apart, right? They may have the same genes, but they've come to vary. And Art Patronus at the University of Toronto and others have come to understand how it is that with age, what happens, you carry the same DNA, but your epigenome, these DNA methylation signals, become increasingly different, and hence these characters become increasingly different from one another. So Phil and Fred, yes, they've got certain genes that are operative, but they come to differ because of these epigenetic states. So, epigenetics. Now, back to motherhood. Epigenetic signals can explain, we think, diversity at the level of cell type, diversity amongst monozygotic twins. Could these same processes explain how it is that the licking of the mother comes to control gene expression over an extended period of time? And so we ask the question, could it be that these epigenetic processes that are so good at creating complexity in the way the genome operates, that they produce these variations in phenotype? And in fact, what we found is that the licking of the mother activates endocrine signals, local neurotransmitter signals involving serotonin. It gets into hippocampal neurons and activates a whole series of transcription factors. And what these factors do, which are driven by the mother's licking, is they remodeled the methylation state of the glucocorticoid receptor promoter. And so when you look in adults, you find that a critical area that determines, a critical area of the genome that determines the level of activity or expression of the glucocorticoid receptor, in animals reared by low-leaking mothers, it carries many more methylation groups than in animals reared by high-leaking mothers. The increased presence of methylation denies access of major transcription factors to this and reduces glucocorticoid receptor expression. In the absence of the methylation, these transcription factors bind more readily, and in the offspring of highs, they turn on the glucocorticoid receptor. So in summary, essentially what happens through this story is that tactile stimulation alters the activity of brain cells, many cells, including those in the hippocampus. That activity can actually drive a remodeling of the methylation state of an area of the DNA that regulates glucocorticoid receptor expression. And in doing so, it regulates the behavioral and endocrine responses of these animals into adulthood. Well, fortunately, through a wonderful collaboration, particularly with Gustavo Turecki at the Douglas Hospital, we were able to start to try to translate this information into humans. And of course, there's caveats here. There's limitations, obviously. But one of the advantages is that we're working with the Quebec Suicide, the Douglas Bell Brain Bank, of which Gustavo is the director. So we can access postmortem human tissue. We can look at exactly the same region in the human that we looked at in the rat. This is the hippocampus. Gustavo has also developed a brilliant forensic phenotyping procedure, validated, in which he interviews family members and friends of the suicide victims or the controls and determines the concurrent level of psychopathology, previous level of psychopathology, as well as the developmental history of the individual. And then what we can do is to look at the same gene. We look at the glucocorticoid receptor gene. So here it is. This is the human variant of the glucocorticoid receptor gene. It's got 9 DNA regions we refer to as exons. These guys produce the glucocorticoid receptor protein. These guys are all regulatory elements or promoters. And each one of them can control the activity of the gene. And the one that's particularly active in brain cells and neurons is this promoter right here. And sure enough, when you look in brain tissue that was obtained by individuals who were victims of suicide compared to those who died accidentally, you find that, first of all, they produce less of the glucocorticoid receptor, and this promoter is less active. So that's the case with suicide. We had enough samples. We started to then dissect this and said, well, could we relate this to the level of depressive symptoms of the individuals? Could we relate it to their drug abuse? And the answer was no. Not at all. And we had good enough sample sizes to do so, saw no effect whatsoever. What we were able to do was to relate it to their developmental history. Amongst the suicide victims, the only group that showed the decrease in glucocorticoid receptor were those who had a history of abuse. Those who were suicide without abuse were no different from controls. It was the abuse that was driving this. And of course, what we then did was to look at the methylation of this very same region that we'd studied in the gene, in the rat, and found that abuse was associated with hyper-increased methylation of this region, which of course we then associated to the decreased expression of the glucocorticoid receptor. And if you remember the rat story, this actually makes pretty good sense. People like Christine Heim and Michael DeBellis and Charles Lee in Chicago have all shown that individuals who are victims of abuse produce more CRF and have greater pituitary responses to stress than individuals who are not. And so the increased glucocorticoid receptor expression in these individuals compared to our abuse sample fits nicely with this emerging story. So adversity, it would seem, is another way of leaving a mark on the epigenome and differentiating between the activity of specific genes. Okay, so just to the conclusion to this point, the function, and by the way, this lecture does actually come to an end at some point. Just, I am aware that, you know, tomorrow's another day and whatever. The function of the genome is regulated by epigenetic signals. That we know. And it appears that those signals can be re-altered by environmental regulation. I'm going to give you a bit more evidence for that. These epigenetic signals reflect the quality of the early environment and guide potentially the development of the brain. And again, I'm going to give you a bit more evidence on that. But what's interesting to consider is that DNA methylation can be, it's not irreversible, but it's a chemically very stable modification to DNA. So it could explain why childhood experience persists over the course of the lifespan. So I give this lecture, and in many cases I'm talking either to an audience of clinicians, to people in public health, people, social workers, etc. And I keep thinking, you know, okay, that's kind of interesting, but whatever. What does this mean in terms of the challenges we face in our healthcare system? Can we actually take this information into and translate it? And this is new, right? These are new efforts to do this. But I'll give you some preliminary evidence of why I think that's important, in particular why it dovetails with what Alan was talking about, the importance of the Ledmer Center. So Gustavo, myself, Moshe Ziff published this paper a number of years ago and showed that childhood adversity regulates the methylation of the glucocorticoid receptor. You'll notice the interesting spelling of methylation. And the intriguing part of these studies was that while we had uncovered this in the brain, none of these studies used brain tissue. They used blood cells or they used buccal epithelial cells that can be gotten from a cheek swab. And yet, despite that, 13 of 14 studies replicated the effect that we found. They not only replicated in terms of its direction, they found it in the same area that we had found it in the brain. And that was appealing, because we know that epigenetic signals can be very different in one cell type compared to another, but here we had a signal that appeared not only in brain, but was also apparent in blood. And the interesting part about that is that you can then study individuals dynamically, because of course you can access blood, or even more easily, cheek cells. And so we started to work with a wonderful psychologist at Mount Sinai, Rachel Yehuda. And we started to ask the question, it's a really rudimentary question. We simply said, could these epigenetic signal, particularly that signal at the glucocorticoid receptor, could it have any relationship to clinical manifestations? And so we looked at PTSD patients. So these were data from 102 U.S. combat veterans of the Iraqi or Afghani theater, 51 of whom suffered with PTSD and 51 without PTSD symptomatology. And what we found was that the methylation of the same region that we'd identified first in the rat and then in the human was highly correlated with symptomatology. So then we said, okay, well, can we take it a step further? And I want to come back to this particular point because these are very preliminary, although published data. Is that as you can imagine, with any clinical population, you bring treatment, in this case psychotherapy. Some people respond very well. They come well out of the clinical range. Other people respond rather poorly. If you look at that in terms of individuals, you can characterize people who are responding but not well versus those who are responding very well. And we ask the question, could the methylation of this site predict who's going to respond to therapy? And the answer, surprisingly, was yes, it can. So what happened was we took a blood sample before the treatment, during the treatment, and following the treatment, and found that the methylation signal at the regulatory region of the glucocorticoid receptor predicted the response of these individuals. And so what it showed was both a decline in CAP scores and a positive treatment effect. Now, there was no change that occurred in methylation. It wasn't as if this is explaining why they got better, but it was indeed predictive of that. Okay, so enough with the glucocorticoid receptor. Let's start asking the question at a broader level. The whole notion here is that the social context within which we developed could leave a signature on the epigenome, on the genome itself, that is manifest in terms of these epigenetic marks. And so we've started to move well away from simply looking at one area of the genome, instead trying to look at across the entire genome. And to do that, we use a tool known as a human methylation bead chip. And it interrogates the methylation status of over, well, close to 500,000 individual base pairs across the genome. So it's a fair piece of data. And this is what it looks like just for one gene. For one gene, you get 34 individual sites across that gene, and you get these methylation scores. And so in this particular area, the regulatory area, the part that controls the expression of the gene, as you can see, is very lightly methylated. So you can actually document methylation across the entire genome. And then the question becomes, can we start to understand variation, individual differences in these methylation signals in terms of the type of events that are of interest to all of us? So this is some work done by our collaborator, led by our collaborator at University of British Columbia. This is Michael Kobar. What Michael's doing is to take this data, he's surveying methylation across the entire genome, and he's asking whether or not factors such as gender, ethnicity, socioeconomic status, etc., can explain, at least in part, variation in methylation across the entire genome. Not surprisingly, he finds an effect of gender and ethnicity. What he also sees is a very pronounced effect of childhood socioeconomic status. He sees no effect of current socioeconomic status. That has no relationship to methylation at the time that you collect these samples, which is really intriguing. Because if anything, you'd think, if this is dynamic, it might be actually determined by, you know, this month, this year's events, rather than early childhood. In fact, it's exactly the opposite. The stress hormone cortisol is associated with this, as well as childhood levels of stress. So Michael's producing data which suggests that these factors are leaving a signature across the epigenome. So we've been collaborating and trying to ask whether or not we can broaden this to include not only sites of adversity, but also potentially intervention programs. It has been our good fortune to partner with David Olds and the Nurse Family Partnership Program. Those of you familiar with interventions will know this as what may potentially be the most famous and well-studied intervention program targeting family function and child development. It is a randomized control trial. And what it does in particular is to target the level of abuse and the potential for abuse within the family. So what David and his team do is they target young, single, low-income first mothers, particularly those that have a poor relationship with their own mother. These are women who are at risk for abusing their children. He then intervenes at the time of mid-pregnancy. There's a nurse family practitioner who visits the mother repeatedly, and those visits persist through to the first 2 years of life. And David has shown that they're effective in reducing the risk. They cut the risk of childhood maltreatment by about 60%. So it's an effective and it has long-term impact in terms of the health and well-being of the kids. So what we started, actually it says 188, this is now about 288 samples. We went back and took blood samples from the kids. We took it 25 years after the intervention was stopped. And we asked the question, can we see a signature in the epigenome that reflects the developmental history of the individual, and in particular, their mother's participation in this intervention? That's all. We're not citing individual regions. We're just asking, if we look at variation across the epigenome in these methylation signals, is there a significant contribution? And for abuse, the answer is absolutely yes. It's a prominent signal. Indeed, when you look at the variation, it may be the single most important factor in determining variation across the methylome other than tissue type. But the interesting thing is we also see an effect of participation in the intervention program. So we can come back 25 years later and explain a certain degree of variation in these epigenetic signals by whether or not mom participated in these. This group received no treatment. Each of these received graded levels of the treatment. So, indeed, these points, I think, are sensitive enough to take us to being able to understand that, yes, we can see these particular signatures. We can see them in areas of the DNA. Okay, and this is why I think it's important. You remember I told you about this and hopefully keeping this in mind. There is no question that kids who live in poverty are more likely to experience these childhood adverse events, right? More than 2.5 times, or about 2.5 times. Let's do the math. This is Clyde Hertzman who's brought this to everyone's attention. About 14% of all the kids in Canada live in poverty. That's way too many, right? If 14% of them, 13.8%, are experiencing these adverse events, that's 2% of the population. Let's go over here for a moment. Yeah, these kids are not as likely to experience, but there's a good percentage of them that do anyway. And they're the majority. 86% of kids who do not live in poverty, right, almost 6% of them experience exactly the same levels of adversity. And they represent 5% of the population. So there's no question poverty is a significant and important influence. But when you look at how it is that poverty particularly disrupts emotional development, is that those effects aren't unique. Family dysfunction is not unique to poor people, right? Not by a long shot. And that's what's doing the damage. So how do we detect this? Well, the challenge, I think, is this. We're in trouble in mental health because, unlike cardiovascular disease, we don't have time to wait. Major forms of mental disorders have onset in late childhood and adolescence. They hit early. So you better get to kids and at least early adolescence if you're going to do prevention work. So it means whatever you're going to get that's going to predict who's at risk, you have to be able to deliver it to pediatric or adolescent populations. And you're going to hear some really interesting stuff on this from Sonia. Poverty itself, yeah, it's a predictor, but most kids who grow up in poverty are in functional families. So if you target poverty alone, it's not going to work. I could make the same statement about low birth weight, the same statement about prematurity. Yeah, they increase the risk, but most kids born small are fine, right? So we really need predictors that can objectively measure the impact of adversity at the level of individuals. What we need in terms of prevention is to treat and intervene at the level of the individual and not simply on the circumstances of the individual. And for that, we're going to need to develop measures. And my argument is they don't have to be biological, by the way, not by any means. But if epigenetics from a cheek swab can tell me who is at risk, then I'm off to the races. There's another element to this, and that is that not only does childhood experience predict an increased risk for depression, it also predicts treatment outcomes. Individuals who went through and experienced childhood maltreatment, Andre Denisi at University College London has shown, these people are less likely to respond to our treatments to depression. So, if these experiences leave an epigenetic mark or a brain imaging signature, could we use them to predict treatment outcomes? And this, in fact, was the basis for a Canadian Foundation of Innovation grant that was obtained at the Douglas with, of course, the participation of the Ledmore Center. And the idea here is that we're going to take individuals as they transverse into our depression treatment program. We're going to do developmental history, brain imaging. We'll take biological samples for genotyping and epigenotyping. And we're going to find if we can predict who is responding to what particular type of treatment. So we're getting down, I think, to being able to understand that. And now we get to the problem that Alan mentioned. This sounds wonderful. And the CFI bought it. They gave us a lot of money. And it is. It's a cool project. But just think for a moment. You collect all this data. You image people, billions of data points, sequence the genome, the epigenome, and this is where we get to the problem that Alan referred to. How do we make sense of all of this particular data in terms of mental health outcomes? How do we mobilize that data to do what the American Heart Association has done, to create an algorithm that's going to tell us who is at risk and who's going to respond well to what treatments? And that's our challenge in mental health. And so the way we're trying to meet that at the Ledmore Center is we've got participating institutes, the Lady Davis Institute, Celia Greenwood and her team in statistical genetics, the MNI, Alan, and the Douglas, ourselves and many of our collaborators down there, Brigitte and Gustavo Turecki and others. And our goal, of course, is to try to bring all of this together so that we can do something with that data, so we can bring mental health into the year 2015 and bring the computing, the mathematicians, the statisticians, the physicists, the chemists, etc., whomever is necessary to be able to help to address these in terms of making sense with all these particular data. And of course, the other thing that we're very optimistic about is that we're not working in vacuum here. We've got a range of particular partnerships and networks, all of which are feeding us with considerable amounts of data, considerable amounts of challenge. And my hope is that we can make some impact on these particular roads. And I thank you very much. So
we can take some questions now, but we still have a session with Sonia.
Let's do Sonia. Let's do Sonia. Then, because, okay, I do Sonia, right? But I'm like, this is the warm-up act, right? Sonia Lupien and I have known each other a long time. And from day one, it was obvious that Sonia is one of the most creative people in neuroscience. And her work at the interface of neuroscience and psychology and in society is absolutely beyond words. You're going to hear a lot, so I'm not going to go at great lengths, but Sonia, I've cherished our previous collaborations, our work together. There is, I think, an enthusiasm in neuroscience. There are some people coming into the field who are bringing a dynamism, a creativity, and an urgency, and she is at the leading of this pack. And so it is with great pleasure and great appreciation to have her speak and participate in this seminar. Sonia.
So good evening, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here. I guess we're going to take the question a bit later on. I'm not sure you're going to believe this or not, but I was trained by Michael Meany, and you will understand at the end of my talk that we took different paths because it's less complicated than Michael, less in the mechanism, but it's the same goal, obviously, is to first understand how it works and how does poverty get under your skin, under your brain, how early adversity will change the way you will see the world perhaps for the rest of your life, and then try to do something about it. So I have only 15 minutes, 20 minutes, and you know, I was coming here trying to figure out what I would talk to you about, and I decided to tell you a story, a real story, about myself as a scientist, and how when you are a scientist working on the effects of stress on the brain, like I do and like Michael does, you know, sometimes you get in front of a wall and you have two choices. You stay there and do nothing, or you just, you know, change the way you look at things and do things differently. And this is what I have done, and I'm having a lot of fun with this. So I want to talk to you about stress on a different way. Michael gave you the mechanism, and I really want to go back to this because I want you to understand something very important about stress, is this stress system and what it does to the brain. And once you understand this, it becomes a bit easy to understand why we do all the things we do, Michael and I and many, many others. So the first thing you have to understand when we talk about human stress is that, because I have the greatest job in the world. I'm paid to stress people every day. I work on human stress, not on rats. And I tried to do rats with Michael, but then I was naming the rats, so I came back crying, saying I killed Ralph, so it didn't work out. I'm better at stressing humans, believe it or not. So the first thing, and I'm summarizing everything Michael has done and many things we have learned, but the first thing you have to understand when we talk about human stress is the following, and it has so much sense for early adversity. It's the following. Your brain, and it starts there and it finishes there, your brain is a detector of threatening information. So your brain was not created to fill out form 111 on the corner of the desk. It will do so until there's a threat in the environment. And when there is a threat in the environment, your brain will never allow you to finish to fill up your form 111. All your attention will go on the threat in order to allow you to do the only two things you can do. If you want to survive, you fight or you get away from the threat. So this is the beautiful stress response, and this is how it works. And as Michael said, and it's so true when you work on human children, is that when you are a child and you grow up in adversity, you become by nature a super detector of threatening information. This is the best way you have if you want to survive. So in the household, these kids are perfectly adapted. They are super detector of threats. If you want to survive, you have to know that, you know, when dad comes in late and he walks very slow and he's like this, there's a good chance he went to, you know, the bar, and then he's drunk, and then he's going to be violent. You should go hide in your room. So you're a super detector of threat. You're perfectly adapted. Now you take this child and you bring this child to a classroom where there is no threatening information. He's totally maladapted for us. So this is the thing you have to understand in terms of human stress. So the way it works is quite easy, and I'm going to put into a picture what Michael told you. When the brain detects a stress, which we call a threat or a stress, it's the same thing at least for me, it activates the hypothalamo-pituitary-adrenal axis that will go, and you know, it will go through the pituitary, and then it will reach the adrenal glands to tell the adrenal glands to produce the stress hormones. Cortisol is one of the hormones. We also have catecholamines, adrenaline, noradrenaline, and these are all stress hormones. Hormones that will allow you to do the only two things you can do in front of a threat: you fight or you get away. In both cases, you need one thing, energy. And it is these hormones that gave you the energy in prehistorical times to either kill the mammoth, eat it and survive, or get away if it was too big. And here you are surviving to the mammoth. So People always say, you know, you will never see mammoth the same way with me. It's true. If I make the link between stress and mammoths, it's because I want you to understand that if you're here today listening to these talks, is because of your ancestors were able to detect threat when they saw the mammoth and mobilize enough energy with these stress hormones to kill the beast, eat it, and survive or get away if it was too big, being available for the next hunt. So we've been measuring this, and we measure this, you know, in humans, we measure this in blood samples. It's not very, very good to measure this in blood sample because I just come in with a syringe and everyone stresses. It's true. So it doesn't work. So in the 1990s, the German colleagues found ways to measure this in saliva, quite easy in saliva. And I'm going to summarize a couple of studies I've done in children. Ladies and gentlemen, it's very easy to ask a six-year-old to spit. The most difficult thing is to ask them to stop. And most recently, we found ways, the Germans again, found ways to measure this in hair samples. So, and it's quite interesting in hair samples because the stress hormones, cortisol, will accumulate in hair sample. It doesn't get away when you wash your hair. And your hair will grow 1 centimeter per month. So if you take 1 centimeter, 3 centimeter of hair from the root, you have 3 months of chronic stress. So that's a very, very interesting measure. So we have been measuring this for many, many years, and Michael summarized a couple of stuff. But the story for me, I'm a neuropsychologist by formation. I'm interested in the brain, learning and memory, emotional regulation, and all the things, thank you, that you have summarized for me before. The story began to be very interesting when we found out a second thing. We found out that the same stress hormones that you produce in order to have enough energy to kill the mammoth or get away if it's too big, within a very short period of time, minutes, the same stress hormones will go back to the brain. And when they get back to the brain, as Michael was summarizing, they have an interesting preference for the brain regions that are involved in learning and memory and in emotional regulation. And it started to make sense, you know. But at first it didn't make sense because we said, you know, why is it in the world that I know that stress is good for survival, so producing stress hormones is good because it gives me the energy I need to survive. But why in the world would the same stress hormones going back to my brain and affecting my memory would be good for my survival? It didn't make sense. Well, it did make sense when we started to think about Bambi. I always give Bambi, you know, Bambi, Walt Disney. It's the Bambi example to understand why even this is good for survival. I'm going to share it with you. Let's say you're Bambi and you're going in the woods this morning and you come face to face with a bear. There's two things you want to do if you want to survive. The first one, you want to mobilize enough energy to get away so you survive. And the second thing you want to do is to remember never to go back there because there's a bear. And it is these stress hormones going back to your brain telling you, never forget this if you want to survive. So it's a beautiful system as long as it is acute. Each time the stress response is acute, it is necessary for survival. You want to have this system. The problem, as Michael said, is when it becomes chronic. When you activate the system days after days after days because there's too many stressors in your life, too many adversities, and by going back to your brain every day, because when it goes down, it goes up after, Michael said, talked about this. So by going back to your brain days after days after days, these stress hormones will slowly but surely modify the way you will interpret the next situation. So the glass will become half empty instead of half full, and this is when stuff like memory problems, problems in emotional regulation will start to appear. So this is what I have been studying for many, many years, and this is an interesting information. This is the biology of the stress response, but for human research, the most important information I find, the most useful for you as parents and as people, is the next slide. So we've done this. We know how it works. I mean, Michael has contributed to this. You have no idea. He's very, very modest, by the way, because he's done much more than that. But as humans, we know that I can put two people in front of the same situation. One will stress and will produce a stress response, and the other not. So it's quite difficult to measure this in humans. But scientists said, okay, fine, but there must be characteristics of a situation, common denominator, that will induce a stress response, the same one, whoever you are, wherever you are, whatever your age, whatever your job. So they've looked for this for many years, and they found what I call the recipe for stress. If there is only one thing you want to remember, it's this. Scientists found that there are 4 characteristics of a situation. I like it. There's not 28. It's 4. 4 characteristics of a situation that will induce the stress response, whoever you are, wherever you are, your age, your job. I challenge you to find a situation in your life that you find stressful that you cannot explain by at least one of these characteristics. You won't be able to find one. And what you have to understand is that a situation doesn't have to have all four characteristics to induce a stress response. The more you have, the worse it is. So here's the recipe for stress, and I'll give you an acronym so you remember it. So in order for a situation to induce this stress response, it has to be novel. It has to be unpredicted or unpredictable. It must be threatening to your ego and someone questioning your capacity to do your job in front of colleagues at the coffee machine on a Tuesday morning. The little feeling you have when you go back to your desk, it's called a stress response. And most importantly, you must have the feeling you don't have control over the situation. Each time a situation has these one or more of these four characteristics, believe me, I stress people every day in the lab, you're going to stress. In order for you to remember this, stress, don't go nuts. Okay? So this is what we've learned, it's fun, etc. Then I was, you know, chatting with Michael about all of these. He got interested in poverty. I was there as well. I said, okay, let's do the study in children. This is when I had 6 years old spitting, you know, 16 years old. So I did a first study with Michael and Bruce McEwen at Rockefeller where I measured the stress hormones, cortisol, in 400 children from 6 to 16 years of age, poor versus rich. And I said, you know, when you're 6 years old, do you produce more stress hormones when you're poor? Well, actually, you do. And what we found is that as early as age 6, poor children produce significantly more stress hormones than rich kids. And it's going to stay like this until age 10. And then at the time of school transition, I'll come back to that. At the time of school transition, both rich and poor children will start significantly increasing their stress hormones. Now, school transition, I don't know if you remember, but it's a very important transition. Remember when you were in the sixth grade, it's not novel, it's not unpredictable, you're the oldest of the school, you have control, okay? You know everyone and your ego is very, very well. Now remember the first time you went into high school, in high school grade one, remember it's novel, unpredictable, threatening to your ego, you don't have the feeling you have control over the situation. And we started to think that perhaps this nuts characteristics of the school transition could be one of the factors explaining this significantly increase in stress hormones that you cannot explain by puberty in these kids. And what is very interesting is usually at the time of school transition that children will start to show the problems related to teenage years, suicidal ideation, depressive symptomatology, conduct disorders, etc. Many parents and teachers will say, well, it's puberty. I said, oh, fine, but perhaps it's stress. In some vulnerable kids that you will find who is the vulnerable one day, no? But it could be the nuts characteristics. I did something else as well. I called the mother, my research assistant called the mothers of all these children. And remember, Michael told you, we know that poor moms are more depressed. We found that for sure. But what I've done, I correlated depression in the mother with the cortisol levels in her own child. And for the first time, I found the spillover effects of parental stress on children. I found that the more mom is stressed or depressed, the more her own child becomes stressed, produces high stress hormones. You know why? Because she becomes the mammoth. If she generates unpredictability, novelty, low sense of control in the child will be able to detect this, not consciously, but the brain system will be able to detect this and produce high stress hormones. I forgot to put this other data, but I also scanned 10-year-old children and found that those who have depressed mothers since their very early age have significantly larger amygdala volume. Remember the data of Michael? We found this as well in these children. So this is the story. Now I want to talk about me. So it's been 15 years, been working on this. I keep showing the negative effects of stress. I know the negative effects of stress on adults. I forgot to tell you, I studied older people. I studied adults. I stress guys and women. I decrease their memory. I've studied children. I've shown the effects of early adversity. And one day, about 5-7 years ago, I'm walking the dog and I get depressed. I said, well, Sonia, what's next? Now that you know all this, are you going to spend the next 10 years, 15 years still showing this? My kids are going to go to high school soon. You're not going to do anything. And I decided this morning, this exact morning, that whatever I would do, good or bad, I would try to do something. So I did a very big switch in my career. I said, I do something. I know there's a window of opportunity. I know the brain is not fully developed until 20. I know what Michael has done. I'm going to do something. and I'm going to have fun, and at least I'm going to have the feeling of doing something. So the first thing I've done, and I've done this with many, many teenagers, school teachers, we had a lot of fun doing this. We created the De-Stress for Success program. And this is for children starting high school in grade one, where we found a significantly higher level of stress hormones. And we've developed this, took us 2 years to validate this, and it's 5 times 1 hour we go into schools, we don't do it. What we do now, we train teachers, so we train the trainer, we do this every year. We train about 300 to 500 teachers every year so that they can give the De-Stress for Success programs. And we calculate with all the teachers we have trained that we have at least, we're able to reach about 36,000 kids so far with the program. So that's a good thing. Now, the program, the kids love it. It's for teenagers, and they have homeworks. And the only thing I want them to understand after 5 1-hour session is the nuts and how to deconstruct a situation in its nuts characteristics. This is one of the homework of the child. So they have to write down the stressor they have. Try this with your kids. They love it. Write down the stressor they have, and for each of the situations, asking themselves, is it new? If it is, you put an X. Was it unpredictable? Yes, put an X. Did I have control over the situation? No. Leave it like this. And they do this for many, many days. While doing this, they learn to deconstruct the situation and its characteristics. They learn that many different situations will stress them for different reasons, and they will find different ways to deal with this. Are they going to say, okay, it's stressful because it's new. What can I do so that it's less new? And they learn a lot of things that I don't have time to share with you. It's 5 hours, so it's not just that. But that's one of the things we do. The kids love it, etc. They have a lot of fun. And I'm a scientist. I'm not just going to do a program, put it out there, and hope that it's going to have good effects. So I found I had a grant, and then I decided to measure the efficacy of the program. So now I went into high school and measured this in 500 teenagers. By the way, it's easy to ask a six-year-old to spit. It takes forever to a teenager to spit. Okay? Why? Because when you're 14 years old and you have to spit in front of your friends, you're like this. Oh, stop it! Stop it! We did it in 500 teenagers. You have an example of a teenager spitting after 2 hours. We've measured stress hormones in saliva 6 times during the school year. We measured cognitive stuff. We measured everything. And I want to tell you a story. The ethic committee told me, what are you going to do? I had a depressive symptomatology questionnaire. And they asked me, what are you going to do if they score high? I said, they will not score high. I said, no. Okay, we decided that I'm going to contact the school psychologist, et cetera, et cetera. And on the questionnaire I was using, there was the famous question 9. 3 statements the child will fill out, which one relates to them. First, A, I never thought about killing myself. B, I thought about it, but I would never do it. C, I want to kill myself. And I had a child, 11 years old to 12, that circled so much the C that his pen went through the paper. And we opened up, you know, a Pandora box with this because we had to send 23 children in pedopsychiatry emergency for suicidal ideation. So for me, it was an eye-opener to see the level of difficulties of these children. So we validated that, and we found that exposure to the program led to significantly decrease in stress hormone levels 1 year after, and depressive symptomatology as well. So that was extremely important for me, and this is one of the best things I have done so far, and we publish the results of this for sure. We were the first study to show that just educating children or teenagers decreases stress hormones. I mean, we have to look for epigenetic effects, Mike. And then dad calls. One day, I'm at my office, and then a dad calls, and he says, I want to talk to you. I said, fine. He says, my son is doing the De-Stress for Success program. I said, fine. He said, I'm a financial broker in Montreal. I said, fine. He says, my son is a teenager. I said, yes. He says, you know, he never talks when we are at dinner table because he's a teenager. Like this. I said, fine. He said, but then one day, he took your stuff, you know, and we are at the dinner table, and we're having dinner, my wife and I, and the child is there, the teen. And I started to talk about my very stressful day to my wife, and then my son talks. And he says, well, for sure, Dad, it's very stressful. It's novel, unpredictable. You didn't have the control. And he said, it made sense. And then he said, oh, Dad, you have to reconstruct. You know, what can you do so that it's less novel? And he then stopped talking. He said, that's why I'm calling you, because you stopped there, you know. Never thought about doing this for workers. I said, well, okay. but I'm not going to do this, you know, the little things. So we did an e-learning program that is called, this is in French now, we're translating it in English, it's called Stress Inc., or Stress et Compagnie in French. It's an e-learning program. It's on a computer. It takes 1.5 hours to do. People have difficulties deconstructing their stress, or it's easy, and it works very well. So when you're done with Stress Inc., if you cannot deconstruct a stressor, you have a problem. So this is just some example of, we have 4 modules. People have to go through each module. I mean, we're going to take you by the hand and bring you in the wonderful world of stress in order to show you how to deconstruct a stressor, find a plan B, put into action your plan B, and if it doesn't work, find a plan C. The only thing you want to do is to tell your brain, calm down, it's not a mammoth, I have control over the situation. And when it does, it is as if the brain was saying, okay, and then you produce less of these things. So we have validated this as well in 70 workers from Les Angeles, so they are quite stressed out people, and it significantly decreases the stress hormones and depressive symptomatology as well. Then one day I was walking the dog, I said, it's not enough. And I wanted to do more. So I took a job as a director of a big research center for one reason, to have means to do changes, to change things. So I had 50 scientists working in humans, and I said, okay, let's do something. We know that we have mobile phone. We know that when a patient gets out of the hospital and is back alone in his apartment all alone, This isolation will bring them back to the hospital. These iPhones that you have in your pockets are something that can link you. Social support is the best buffer against stress that can link you with the others. So we decided to develop mobile application for mobile phone. And the first one, I'm going to talk about this one, but the one from my other scientists as well, because they're very nice, and I'll finish with this. The first one is iSmart. One morning I was walking the dog, and I said, what happens? The problem with stress, you know what it is? It impairs memory. I know that. I've been showing it for many years. So you forget about your stressor. It is as if the system, this is what the system wants, but you forget about them, so they accumulate. And then you end up, you know, a burnout, depressed, because you let them accumulate too much. So I said, what we need is an alarm system. You are stressed, you forget about it, but if the system detects something, someone in your house, it's going to buzz you. So iSmart is that. It's for stress monitoring and resolution technology. Basically, it's very simple. It's an app on your iPhone, and you decide how many times per day you want the app to call you, just to buzz you. And then it buzzes, and then it just asks you one question. On a scale of 1 to 10, are you stressed? 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And then you score, and you forget about it. And then it's going to do this and do this and do this and do this. You can look at your results if you want, but you can forget about it. This is what you're going to do. But the thing is that if the system detects a pattern, it will buzz you. And then it's going to say, aha, I found a recurrent stressor every Tuesday 5 p.m. Is there anything happening Tuesday 5 p.m.? Yes, my mother-in-law comes for dinner. Do something. If you can do something, do something. But if there is nothing, because it's possible that there is nothing, it's going to ask you to go in phase two. Phase two will be 4 questions now. First one, are you stressed? If you score more than 7, it's going to ask you, is it novel? Is it unpredictable? It's going to help you deconstruct your stressor, showing you what happens every day and what you can do about it as well. We validated iSmart as well, and we found that it significantly decreases the stress hormones, and people love it because it was able to detect chronic stress patterns in 67% of people, and people were very surprised when they were being buzzed. It's, oh, what? Yeah, there was a pattern. I told you I became director because I wanted to change things, so I got $1 million from Bell Canada, the big philanthropy action of Bell Canada, to develop mobile application as well, not for the iSmart, but for mental health as well. And this is an application I really like. It's from Réal Labelle, one of the scientists of my research center. He's an expert on depression and suicidal ideation in young adults and teenagers, but it applies to anyone. And it's a system that when you go to your psychologist, you can do a cognitive therapy. And it's fun. The problem is that with cognitive therapy, people always do, they don't always do the homework they have to do. Now, when you have PC assistance in your hand, it's going to make you do your homework wherever you are. Anna, are you stressed out? Are you being depressed right now? What is this idea you have, etc.? And the results are sent to the psychologist. So you always are in contact with your psychologist, and when you go and see the psychologist, he or she knows exactly where you are. It's fun. It's not enough. Real is an expert on suicidal ideation. I've learned a lot of things on suicide. I've learned that suicide is an impulsive act, for sure. And usually you have about 30 seconds to do something when this suicidal thought gets into your brain. If you don't do nothing, there's a risk that you will go and take action. Now, the problem, what the clinicians were doing in the office, they would say to people, find five people that you could call anytime you have a suicidal idea, and they will answer. And then you would put this on a piece of paper and hope that you find the paper if you have a suicidal idea. Okay? So I said, this doesn't work. What happens if you are in the subway and the paper is stuck on your fridge at home? It doesn't make sense. So, and the thing is that if you try to do a phone call, it doesn't answer, and you try a second one, by the third one, you are at 35 seconds. It's too much. So we made a deal with the École de Technologie Supérieure here in Montreal. These are geeks. And we sat with them, and we said, we need to find a way so that when there is a suicidal idea, they push one button and it does anything it has to do. The person is totally certain that it will talk to someone within 30 seconds. So they did that. It's called l'appel dispersif in French. So the patient puts the phone number of five people who all agree to answer if they are called because they have a suicidal idea. We put the number into the iPhone, and if they have a suicidal idea, they just push this button. It sends this to the server at the ETS who calls the five person all at the same time. The first one answer shuts down all the others. 21 seconds for this. We spend an entire summer testing this. And if by 21 seconds no one answer, it sends it to the police, to 911, to Suicide Action, etc. It's a beautiful, it has been patented. It's a beautiful system. It works very well. It's pushing this now toward France. It's very, very nice. This, and, oh, yeah, as well, it's going to geolocalize you. Send you a map and say, okay, this is where you can go right now. You have a hospital right there, so you have this and you have this. Because people want to do something when they have a suicidal idea. They just don't have the information to do something. So it's going to provide them with what they need. This one as well, I'm going to finish with this. This one I like a lot. It's Isabelle Ouellette-Morin. She's a young scientist that Michael and I trained when she was doing her PhD. She did her postdoctoral fellowship in London, and I was able to bring her back to my center. She got really much interested in the mobile application. She's an expert in bullying. Now, in bullying, I learned a lot of things as well with her. But you can be a victim, but you can also victimize yourself. You can internalize this state and start to see yourself as a victim. And what scientists in London learn is that you can get out of this. And when you get out of this, this is when you can ask for help. So I don't have a lot of time, and I don't have all the slides for this, but Plufard is exactly this. She was able to convince very popular actors for children or teenagers to do free capsules for the kids, and they gave them strategies, etc. This is the best success I've seen so far. The kids love it, and she validated it as well. So I'm going to finish with this. My main goal in life, and I'm getting there, is I was working with teenagers, and I said, draw stress. Draw how you feel. Just this. I have many, many drawings. And the best gift I had so far is to see Juliette, 12 years of age, going before distress a drawing like this to this. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Sonia and Michael, for a real tour de force. The thing I'm going to take away is that the stress you've had manifests itself in your hair. So next time I come home and my wife says, you look like you've been shot out of a cannon, you'll know why. We're going to have a question and answer session now, so I hope that you've been writing your questions, and we'll get to you in a minute. But while we're gathering the questions, I just want to make a couple of comments and some housekeeping notes. First of all, I want to just mention the reason the why we're all here. I mentioned at the outset the Ludmer Center, the vision. I didn't discuss Irving Ludmer and his wife, Freema. Donors often donate money because they have a particular interest in a particular disease, a brain tumor or a stroke. It's very rare to have somebody who believes in a vision, the vision that we started to articulate tonight, the integration of genetics, epigenetics, imaging, behavior, in understanding the brain, both in poverty, in child development, in adversity. Irving Ludmer understood that vision from the outset, that if we could come up with a new approach to science where we could combine all of this information under one roof, then the applications were endless. And Irving has been behind us from the outset, and we've only just got this off the ground in the last year, but it's been 5 or 6 years of his perseverance that brought this vision into reification and reality, and it's going to be an exciting ride over the next few years. I have to speak a little bit about the next lecture. That's going to be me. I'm going to talk about another side of the Ludmer Center, the whole world of brain imaging, structure and function in the brain, and how it manifests itself in various brain disorders and in normal brain development. Please, if you have a moment, fill in the forms that you've been given, which asked you to provide a survey response to us. This is the first time that we've developed this format. We're learning as we go, and we'd like to take into account your thoughts on the format for the next lecture, which will be in March. So at that point, I think I'll start the questioning period. If we have the lady here is very keen to ask a question, so why don't we start with you? Yes. Right. Yes. So this.
Teachers that when children were exhibiting the behaviors that you all spoke about, that maybe it had to do with something that they were living at home, and teaching them about stress and stress management. Even before I found Hans Selye's little book, Stress and Distress, before you probably even studied with him, because I entered the School of Social Work in 1972, and I did about 40 years, and now I continue as a volunteer. But one of the things, and I worked at doing all those parenting programs, working with the families, really making a difference, working in teams with social workers, doctors. It was an incredible career. But what I want to say, what really, really worries me, I'm thrilled to see some of my heroes here speaking and what you've developed. But what really terribly worries me, and what I hear from my colleagues that are still working on the front lines, and I was a McGill field instructor for many years too, with these master's and bachelor students, is the cuts that Quebec and Canada is doing. Because even when I was there, I was trying to tell them that when you work with families that have experienced the kind of traumas that you can't have the assembly line approach. It didn't work for GM, for General Motors, and it certainly doesn't work for these families. And as the years went by, we had much higher and higher and higher caseloads, and naturally more and more social workers and nurses and doctors, et cetera, were all burning out. So how come, if we know all this and we've known it for a long time, we were doing these amazing programs for a long time, how come we can't be the ones? What can we do? Can't we be talking to the people in power, like Barrette and Couillard, who they're doctors, and people in administration, and there's an election coming, to make a difference so that we can put this into practice and not cut the most vulnerable populations from health, education, and social services.
I doubt there's anyone in the room who would disagree with you. I can just give you my personal experience in dealing with particular ministers, and it's idiosyncratic. I mean, Irving and Alan can tell you are going to see Yves Bolduc, who was the Minister of Education at the time, who was remarkably sympathetic to this particular approach. And, of course, he got fired. What you see in politicians is very little commitment to evidence-based decision-making. It's the problem. We turn around and we say, look, this is ridiculous. I mean, Rebecca can tell you about the amount of work done in health economics, right? Nobel Prizes accorded in health economics saying, this is what you can save if you do this. And better than that, even in some ways, is this is what your economy can gain if you invest in children, right? The day is there, and you know it as do I for this. What you get, and a colleague of mine, well, Rémi Quirion serves this role in Quebec, but a colleague of mine is the chief scientific officer to the Prime Minister of New Zealand. And so he would go and talk to the ministers. He's at a cabinet level. And the evidence notion, they're ideologues. They come with a set of beliefs. And that's it. And you can play the evidence out. And he will tell you that the only minister who really has gotten the point about everything you're saying is his Minister of Finance. You think that's funny? I think that's funny too, actually. But ironically, Brain Canada, one of the most ingenious establishments in Canada, funding mental health research, was set up by Michael Wilson, previous Minister of Finance. So the problem is, yes, you need to continue to make these arguments, but the problem is we have ideologues at the other end, right? It's one of the reasons why at the beginning I made this case about I grew up poor, I made it, I'm successful. If you grew up poor and you're not, it's your fault, right? And so that's one of the reasons why we need to go, you know, and make the science. But you're dealing with ideologues in many cases, and that's the frustration.
I had nothing to add. I mean, one day, just one thing, I went to the federal government because CIHR had a bunch of scientists and they said, we're going to bring the scientists to the minister and everything and they're going to talk, you know, about what they do. So I said, okay, we can do something. So I go to Ottawa and, you know, get there. And then I all dressed up very well, you know. And then the guy sits, I don't even remember the name, Seastress, and he says, you have 1 minute.
All right. So you see right away one of the problems that you have of trying to moderate scientists is that they'll just go and go and go and go. So, Michael, is it possible to demethylate the DNA biologically?
Yes. Yes, it is. To demethylate, yes, in fact. I'll cut very quickly. Brain cells in adults have at least as much of the enzymatic machinery necessary to methylate or demethylate or change forms of methylation as they do at any particular stage over life. David Sweat has shown that learning and memory in the prefrontal cortex involves rapid demethylation of particular targets. Our collaborator, Eric Nessler, has shown that exposure to drugs produces demethylation at some sites and methylation at others. So, yes, there's no question that the adult brain, and the reason I think that's so interesting, of course, is that that suggests to us that reversibility remains a continuous possibility.
And does it transmit into offspring?
Is it transmitted to offspring? Okay, somebody wants details, right?
Not that many.
You'll get your talk. By the way, if you want to really see the brain this lad has developed the software used by most neuroimagers in the world. The pictures, the graphics, the understanding of the brain and its organization from him is absolutely amazing. So a little plug. It's possible because we used to think, I'm going to get into the weeds a little bit, but it used to think that germ cells the DNA was completely demethylated. The methylation was completely erased and then reestablished, so there was no way a methyl mark could persist from one generation to the next. And that's now known not to be the case. Most of the DNA methylation marks are wiped away, but there's a lot of cases in which it's not. And so that process can, in theory, I think it accounts for a limited amount of what we think of as transgenerational transmission. There are other processes. If somebody wants to stick around afterwards, I'd be glad to get much deeper into the weeds. But yes, it can occur, but it's probably a limited source of transmission from one generation to the next in terms of pure DNA methylation.
Sonia, can you address the critical periods issue, and do we have, can we have methods to deal with identifying those critical periods?
With the what?
Critical periods.
What I mean? I don't know what you mean by the question. I mean critical periods.
Periods very early on in development when...
We don't know the critical periods in humans. I mean, we know that, as Michael said, that, you know, if mom is stressed out, we have programming effects on the brain of the child, of the offspring. And I don't know if these programming effects are irreversible or not, and I'm not sure we know by now. So for sure, one of the critical periods is when you are in the womb. And then postnatally, at least in humans, we have many, many critical periods, but, you know, the early life, as Michael will show with, you know, I would say, Sonia talking, not science, but as long as the child still needs an adult to be able to deal with the stressors of life, this is an amazingly critical period. And so when the child is very young, I mean, as I always say, when a child is very young, 0 to 5 or 6 to 12, it is the parent who can deal with the nuts characteristic of a situation. And this is why it's a critical period. But perhaps Mike has something to say.
It also relates to this next question. That what happens when a parent or mother dies at age, when the child is 3.5 years, and you don't remember them at all?
That's actually piggybacks right onto it. There was a movement a number of years ago called the 0 to 3 movement, right? And many of you will remember it. And it was to emphasize the importance of early childhood. And I'm entirely sympathetic with that, but it was terribly overstated. And I really love Sonia's answer. I think that to the extent that the brain, the frontal cortex, which we've both emphasized tonight, is mature, fully mature, at 21, 22 years of age, there's a long window of opportunity for that to occur. Parental loss is one of the interesting things, because psychiatrists have actually, to some extent, created a really interesting and somewhat counterintuitive argument with respect to parental loss. The critical period, parental loss is highly predictive of later depression. And parental loss, correct me if I'm wrong, Rebecca, but the critical period there is not early, it's later. It's between 6, 8, 9, 12 years of age. 0 to 3, it doesn't have an increase in predictive value. That, I think, Michael Rutter has shown that and others. So in this particular case, it's the loss in later childhood, even in early adolescence, that actually has a more profound impact. And I think the other thing that's interesting, Martin Teicher, who's at Harvard, has done imaging studies on kids that experience severe maltreatment. This is profound emotional and physical neglect of sexual and physical abuse. And there are, at any particular age, effects. But what part of the brain is affected depends on what age. So areas, for example, like the amygdala tend to be affected earlier on in life. Areas like the hippocampus and prefrontal cortex are more affected later. So you can see comparable effects, but not entirely. And so, I mean, I think Sonia's right. It's not that there's a critical period during when this occurs or not. The question is the age at which these adversities occur is going to determine to some extent their effects on the brain and thus their clinical.
Can I just say something? And 3 years, the question also said, why will I not remember anything if it was 3 years of age? It's the reminiscence bump. You know what it is? The reminiscence bump is the hippocampus develops. It's there at birth, and it develops quite a lot between 0 and 3 years of age. And the reminiscence bump, you all have one. It's different. It's the earliest age at which you can remember something. I mean, the first memory you have, it's when, you know, we think that the hippocampus and all the brain structures related to that were starting to be fully developed so that anything you encode can stay there.
I've got two questions here which are similar in intent. What has shown to work at reversing childhood experiences, mindfulness, belief, perception, psychotherapy, a childhood? In essence, are we doomed if you experienced adverse conditions? And let me read the other question, which is, how do spiritual values and material values balance out in a healthy family environment? Does money configure it all? So the issue here is, can we reverse early adversity?
There's two questions, actually. There's the first, I'll take it briefly, because Sonia can talk more about religiosity and spirituality, etc., is generally a protective factor. And even, for example, Tony Earls, who did some wonderful work on the south side of Chicago, which, if anyone's familiar with it, is a terribly impoverished and highly violent area. And he found that there were neighborhoods in which people did not have the rates of heart disease or diabetes or mental health problems that would be expected given the violence and the poverty, and found that those were areas in which people were very closely linked to their church. And so spirituality is, in fact, a protective effect. To come back to the other point, this is really quite interesting. So I mentioned very briefly that André Denisi has shown that the presence of childhood maltreatment predicts treatment resistance in depression. It's resistance to antidepressant medications. What he actually found, and Charlie Nemiroff had found this earlier, is that patients with a history of maltreatment respond better to psychotherapy than to antidepressant medications. And so that, in fact, there's interesting evidence that we've got a guideline here. Now, you know, in the strictest sense, we need more evidence than this. But Denisi found that maltreatment predicts resistance to antidepressants, but not to psychotherapy. And Charlie, in a huge study, had shown that psychotherapy was more effective in individuals with a history of abuse than were the antidepressants. So I think we're on the cusp of being able to say, look, here's a situation in which we can actually use the developmental history to guide us in the treatment of individuals. And yes, there is considerable evidence for the therapeutic benefits of mindfulness across a wide range of individuals, mindfulness training in particular. Now, mindfulness training, I'm going to ask you this question. Mindfulness training is the evidence for it is really good. There's some wonderful neuroimaging studies on mindfulness training. But doesn't it sound a little bit like cognitive behavioral therapy in some ways?
Cognitive behavioral therapy is taking your ideas. You know what we have? It's called cognitive distortion, and I'm very interested in that. It's the way we see the glass half empty, half of us. And the other half, we see half full. Those of us seeing it half empty, I'm not saying we're depressed, we're just seeing it half empty, then we're suffering. And so cognitive therapy will try, with the help of a psychologist, to modify your thinking so that you stop having these cognitive distortions. Half of people will respond, the other half will not. Now, mindfulness therapy, what it does, it tells you something very, very important, and I really like that. The problem we have so far, and I'm going to take 1 minute, Michael, Alan, for that, is the following, and many people in this field have said that, is that we want to avoid negative emotions. We think that negative emotions are very, very, very bad, and we have to avoid them and do anything we can about fill them up with positive stuff and, you know, take alcohol, and we cannot have negative ideas. Now, many scientists now are starting to see why they're good for survival. We hate pain, right? We don't want pain, yet we have pain. Why do you have pain? Because pain is there to tell you, take out your hand out of the oven or something like that. So it's a signal that your brain sends you to say, you should do something. And some scientists are starting to say that negative emotion is exactly that. It's just a signal sent by a brain to tell you, perhaps you could do something, but not, you know, trying to fill it up with a lot of other things. So mindfulness, what it does, it's telling you very interesting stuff. First, accept it, and they're right. Accept that it's there. Don't avoid it. And just wait, and it's going to go. Let it go. So we are very interested in that. And in my lab, we do a lot of studies now on the very big kid on the block these days in the human stuff. It's called mind wandering. mind wandering, you know, you're doing something and you're thinking about something else, and there's this guy in the journal Science did this, the easiest study I ever saw, took an app, an iPhone, buzzing you many times a day, asking you, are you thinking about what you're doing or doing mind wandering? 1 to 2. And then asking people the second question, are you happy? And then he found that those people who report a lot of mind wandering are not happy. And this is when they started to say, what can we do to get rid of mind wandering? Mindfulness. And this is why they put them in scanners.
I'll just throw in a quick comment. There are many studies out there where people have looked at, for instance, hypnotism, or Zen Buddhists or yogis, and I've demonstrated massive changes in blood flow in the brain. So there is a direct neural consequence of some of these more spiritual concepts. It affects the brain, and obviously then it affects the whole pituitary, HPA axis, and stress. Okay. How is poverty abuse defined, and is it the same criteria worldwide? And just before you answer, another question. Why do you conflate poverty and abuse / family strife, violence? Would richness predict emotional regulation?
So, okay, can I take
of all,
the last one?
Poverty.
Okay, no. Can I take the last one? Because the other, I can't define poverty. No, why do I conflate poverty and family dysfunction? I'm not conflating them. I'm saying family dysfunction is more likely to occur under circumstances of poverty, but not for a second. In fact, what I'd hoped, and maybe I wasn't as clear as I should have been,
and usually am,
is that family dysfunction is certainly not unique to circumstances of poverty. It's more likely to occur in those conditions, but it is not unique to that. And in fact, the problem is that statistically, since most people are fortunate not to live in poverty, most dysfunctional families are not poor, just in terms of actual raw numbers. Poverty is a horrible stressor. I mean, Sonia, for example, this was such a powerful study you did showing that the effects of poverty on cortisol were mediated by maternal depression. The weight of poverty, constant problems, constant. It's not simply the financial concerns. It's the lack of access to resources. It's the inability to be able to simply indulge, have a little fun, etc. I mean, it's an incredible weight. So not surprisingly, it wears on both parents, it wears on their relationship, and it wears on the relationship to the children. Nevertheless, most families that live in poverty are functional. Right? This is just a question that in poverty you find enrichment for family dysfunction, meaning it's more likely to occur, and you find enrichment for the psychological problems that derail the lives of young children and adolescents. Certainly didn't mean to suggest that those are the only places it occurs, by any means. In fact, that's the problem. If it only occurred in impoverished environments, we could target it. It occurs everywhere.
And how do we measure poverty?
Yeah,
Susan King, I did a study with Susan. She taught me how to do that. But it's an algorithm with three factors, like family income. You put all this in the algorithm, education and the type of work. And usually you come with something that is accepted in science. Now, just after, there's something else. This is the objective measure of poverty. But then Teresa Seaman and many others in the United States started to be interested in perceived social economic status. Because you can be from middle class and think you're still poorer than Fred, you know, and you're poor. So what they did, they asked, I think they give a ladder. And people have to say if they are at the bottom of the ladder or the top. It's their perceived SES. And they find similar stuff than with income. And many people in this room could be better than I to summarize this. But it's not just the objective thing. It's, again, your cognitive distortion. This is the interesting factor for the next decade, I would say.
I've got a few questions here which are essentially asking for more information about the street corner book and about the can we get at the De-Stress for Success program and say more about the iFort bullying app. Basically, all these sorts of questions we can provide answers to on our websites, and we will contract to do that.
Street Corner Society, by the way, is still available on Amazon. And it's every bit as good.
Here's one that fascinates me. What is the impact of the removal of the amygdala has on stress handling? Did they do that?
Not intentionally. why did we never think of this? Damn. Amygdaloid lesions, for example, render people absolutely oblivious to threat. They're extremely damaging. Yeah, they absolutely become, not to pain, by the way, but to threat. They become oblivious to threat, and it's everything you would think if you imagine the amygdala to be, as Sonia said, the sensor of threat in the brain. And bilateral amygdaloid lesions do exactly that.
And I just want something. Add something. All of this stuff in there, Lo, is there for a reason. We want an amygdala, and we want to have fear. As I always say, in my mind at least, the 14-year-old boy putting himself on top of a cocaine line is not scared enough. Fear is not there enough. And that drives the decision to take this line that will bring him on a pathway. So he needs an amygdala.
Has anyone seen the movie Inside Out?
Hey, that's good.
Yeah. Sadness. Right, it's a wonderful. I mean, it makes the point Sonia was making. There's a tremendous adaptive value to these otherwise negative emotions.
Here are two good ones. How can we begin to understand children who display all of these similar behaviors but haven't suffered early trauma or poverty?
Did they?
You've talked. So you talk about kids that have gone. We're talking about the most common pathway. Poverty, by the way, is not. There's certainly family dysfunction. You find frequently instances of children with serious behavioral problems, emotional problems, in completely functional families. It absolutely happens. There is, to some extent, the appeal to perhaps some peculiar circumstances of fetal and prenatal development. More often than not, we think that there's some things that's occurred with respect to family history, to hereditary, etc. But it's absolutely true. You see kids in practice, clinical practice, in which it is very difficult to sit down and start to understand the precursors to these particular events. And the interesting question then is, would you treat that child differently than the child for whom you can identify childhood maltreatment as a major source? And that would be interesting to know.
Okay, I'm going to take one more question. We could go on all night, but I understand that the people have lives. So the last question is, could you comment on the impact of war and refugee experience on children and their developing brains?
By war and refugees?
So we're peripherally associated, very peripherally associated with an incredible project led by a psychologist at Harvard, Teresa Betancourt, who's doing emotional regulation intervention with the children in Sierra Leone who were forced into child's armies. And I suppose, maybe I'm being naive here, but I'm just amazed that she can get the clinical effects that she does, given what these kids have actually been through. I mean, there are instances in which some of these children were shooting their parents, right? So we're talking about the most extreme form. Interestingly, what Teresa focuses on is emotional regulation. But she's seeing incredible benefits of reintroduction of these kids into society that I think are surprising in to the degree of their success. I mean, I certainly don't want to suggest that this is a panacea. I mean, these kids are going to carry these scars, but the success that she's experiencing is formidable. The biggest problem these kids have is with emotional dysregulation.
I just want to say something as well, that it's not as simple as we describe it here. Sometimes it's more complicated than that. And I will always remember this woman. She was from Panama. And she told me something one day that I still remember. She looked at me, we were talking about stress. She said, "Listen, girl, I've got 16 kids. I'm way too busy to be stressed out." And this reminded me of the importance of looking at the difference between an absolute stressor and a relative stressor. An absolute stressor is a real threat to your survival. Yeah? War, someone coming here and saying, "Fire!" If someone comes here and says, "Fire," I'm not going to start asking you, "Well, it's novel, eh? It's unpredictable." We're not going to do this. We're going to start, you know? So the human machine is perfectly fit to deal with an absolute stressor. It's a superb machine. But we, today, here in this world, we are surrounded by relative stressor, meaning that you are going to produce a stress response, whether you see the situation as being novel and predictable. And again, this is the way we see the glass. And I think we pay a lot of price for that because the system is not good for this one.
I think that's a perfect point to end the proceedings. I'd like to thank Annette Novak from the McGill Communications and Events Office, who was instrumental in organizing this meeting, along with Joanne Clark, the executive director of the Ludmer Center, and of course Chantal Caron, administrative assistant, and all of the volunteers who gave up their precious time to come and help us out and make this meeting a success. Michael and Sonia and myself will be available if anybody wants to come down and ask more questions. I apologize that we couldn't get through all of these. It's been fascinating for me. I hope you enjoyed it, and I look forward to seeing you all again in March. Thank you very much.